Recently, I was walking my dog around my building on the ledge. A lot of people are afraid of heights, not me. I'm afraid of widths. I have a 3-year-old dog and named him Stay. He's a lot of fun when he's a puppy because when I call him, I would say, come here, Stay, come here, Stay.
That's stand-up comedian Stephen Wright. Stephen has been making people laugh for more than 40 years with his deadpan delivery and his carefully constructed and surreal jokes. He also paints and makes music and is closer than you may think to the prestigious EGOT Lifetime Achievement. In 1989, Stephen won an Oscar for Best Short Live-Action Film for The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. During the acceptance speech, Wright said, "We're really glad that we cut out the other 60 minutes." That's so Stephen Wright. He told us how he became interested in comedy and how he developed his trademark style.
There was a radio show in Boston on Sunday nights, and this person played 2 comedy albums every Sunday night. I was about 16 years old, and I found it by accident because I was trying to listen to a Bruins game, and you know the Bobby Orr days.
Oh yeah,
and I was going through the dial, and I stumbled on this comedy program, and I had already been watching Johnny Carson all the time, and I had it in my head that my dream would be to be a stand-up comedian. So I heard all these albums. I tuned in every week from years, and I was like studying it by accident, and I heard everyone's albums. Woody Allen had a double album made before he did movies, and he had these jokes within these stories, and I learned like how to structure a joke from him, and I was also influenced by George Carlin in the sense of all his material was like just noticing almost mundane things in life. And then so when I went to do stand-up, you know, everyone's head is like a soup. It's like made up of different influences over the years, no matter if you're gonna be creative or not. It's like everything is a combination in your own head. So then when I went to do stand-up, it was just observational stuff and the structure of a joke I learned from those albums.
With your style of humor, it seems like you need to have so many more jokes than the average comedian to fill a set. What's your process like for writing and mentally storing all of them?
Well, it to me, it's normal because I've never done it any other way. I mean, so the joke is like 5 seconds. If they laugh at the joke, it's 5 seconds, including the laugh, maybe 8 seconds. But I've never done it another way, so to me it's normal. I know people tell long stories and everything, but I never think, oh man, poor me, I have to tell 10 jokes in 1 minute. I don't think of it like that.
Right.
It's just how it is.
Yeah. So you avoid pop culture material in your act. Is the reason you do that to keep your material timeless, or do you just find pop culture too fleeting?
2 reasons I didn't want to do that, because one reason was a lot of comedians did talk about those things. So then I thought, well, if they're talking about that, I don't want to talk about that. And also I was influenced, like I said, by George Carlin about talking about everyday little things like lint and the speed of light and, you know, it's not. And then also then it was timeless.
Like, yeah.
The gravity is not going to be. You couldn't be talking, I mean, Jimmy Carter would be weird to talk about, but gravity is not going to go out of style.
No, it never is. It never is. And lint is never going to go out of style. It's got a long shelf life.
Lint and gravity.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the speed of light, maybe the speed of lint. There might be something. Lint moves pretty slowly, I think. Yeah. Is there a joke? You've written so many jokes, but is there one joke that you can point to as a favorite, or the joke that you've written that you're most proud of?
There is one joke that is my favorite, and it doesn't even get the biggest laugh. It gets like a 6 or a 7. And one reason I like it is because usually when I think of a joke, instantly I have the wording in the joke comes right immediately.
Oh, really?
Within 30 seconds or a minute. It's like, it's only, to me, my mind, like, it's like a factory and it assembles the wording quickly, and the wording is to have the least amount of words.
Yes.
How can you get to the point with no fluff involved?
Yeah.
But this other joke had this was a weird joke because it took a while for me to figure it out. I mean, I wasn't sitting down like writing it over and over, but my mind was thinking about it. And then occasionally it would come up with it. So the joke was, I went to my grandfather's wake, and I was kneeling down at the casket, and I saw him inside the casket, and I was with my aunt. She was beside me, and I started thinking about the batteries inside my flashlight. And then I said to my aunt, maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's just in the wrong way. Now, that is my favorite joke. I mean, no one ever points it out like, oh, that's my But to me, why it is I like the you know, you put batteries out on the table, and then you put the dead ones and the new ones, and if you don't know which one, you can't tell by looking at them.
That's beautiful.
Also, there was a giant amount of information to be conveyed. And then when I figured out that small amount of words to do that, I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that with us. In 1982, you got your big break with an appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and you've been a fixture on the late shows ever since, including recurring spots on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. What is the secret to finding success in the late night comedy space?
The Craig Ferguson stuff, he's not on anymore, but that was a fascinating section of my career, because I never did improv before, so when I would sit and talk to him for like 8 minutes, it was all just made up, and his mind is incredible. He's one of the most brilliant comedians I've ever seen.
Everything's connected.
Yes,
I see.
So it depends on how you look at it.
Most things are, you know, dependent on how you look at them, except things you can't see.
Yes, music.
Music, for example. Yeah, music's very good.
Doesn't matter how you look at music.
No, no. I mean, unless you're playing it, unless you're reading the music and then playing it, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll read music and then listen to a book on tape. And we would just go back and forth with just insane concepts. I mean, if you ever looked them up and watched them. To me, it looked like, I didn't think of this when it was happening, but in hindsight, it was like two guys were in an insane asylum, and they were in a room, like, waiting for their doctor appointments. Like, they bring them into a room, and this would be the conversation until one of them, okay, Mr. Ferguson, so your doctor will see you now. You know,
with
two insane people.
Yeah.
It was fascinating because when you do stand-up, it's like you're there alone, of course, and it's all on you. But with him, if you said something that didn't work, it didn't matter because he would say something that would work.
Yeah. So that was obviously, that was really fun to watch because it was a great meeting of two great comedic minds. So, and you enjoyed that, doing improv?
Yeah, I did, loved it because it was just different for me because stand-up was so slowly figured out, like under a microscope. And this was more just like making stuff up like you were in a bar.
Right, yeah.
Someone...
Yeah. In 1988, you wrote and starred in the Academy Award-winning short film, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. This was a hilarious adaptation of your comedy into the film medium. Why did you want to make this film?
Just wanted to see if we could get my angle into my way of thinking into a film version. And then I was going to write it with my friend Mike Armstrong. Then we had to do it, and over the years, I knew Mike since from college. We made so many jokes about psychiatrists or scenarios, weird scenarios. Mm-hmm. Imagine this and that. So then, that's why it was about that.
Yeah,
we had a history of making fun of psychiatry.
Well, it's been bothering me for a while now. I spend a lot of time and energy on it. Something that's very important to me. I want to find out who my real stepfather is. My natural parents won't tell me where he is, but I'd really like to find him. I just have this curious need that I have to satisfy.
It was a great experience, and Dean Pariseau, he directed it, and it was like a big. We made it for HBO, and we had no idea. They wanted to play it in theaters. That was their idea.
Huh.
So then when it played in theaters, it became nominated, and then it won. I mean, we weren't even thinking of the theater world. So It was like we had this dart, like the show, the movie was a dart, and we finished it, and we threw it to HBO, and then a big gust of wind came and made it stick into this other bullseye. Wait, oh, where did it go? Oh, it's an Academy Award. Oh, okay. Yeah. And then they put it on HBO.
Yeah. As you mentioned, this film, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, was directed by Dean Pariseau, and Dean's wife was the late Sally Menke, who in 1992 was editing Quentin Tarantino's debut film, Reservoir Dogs. You were picked to be the voice of the K. Billy DJ, and you literally became the voice of the film. Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, Sally Menke, she edited Dennis Jennings, and I met her and Dean at the same time, and we became friends, and then she was editing Reservoir Dogs, and it was almost all completely finished. They knew they had the radio section, but they didn't have the guy, the announcer, in there, and then she suggested to Quentin Tarantino that what about Stephen Wright, and he liked the idea. So then, I mean, he wasn't even known at all then. That was the first movie. It wasn't the movie, of course, it wasn't even out yet. But I trust Sally said to me, look at this guy. She had edited a bunch of other movies before that. Mm-hmm. She said, this guy is really something. This is a different type of situation, this person. And I just trusted her judgment. That's why I agreed to do it. Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty were a duo known as Steeler's Wheel when they recorded this Dylan-esque pop bubblegum favorite from April of 1974. That reached up to number 5 as K. Billy Super Sounds of the 70s continues. And, of course, she was right.
Yes.
And so I'm happy to be in there.
And it also introduced you to a whole new generation of fans.
Yes, there's a lot of people who know me from that movie who didn't even know I did stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
This whole other situation.
Yeah. You've done comedy for so long, and yet you've only released two albums, 1985's I Have a Pony and the 2006 album When Leaves Blow Away. They've both been nominated for Grammys. I'm just curious, why haven't you released more comedy albums?
Because I like to have a lot of the show where they haven't seen the audience doesn't know it.
Right, that makes sense.
You know, and plus I don't know how much stuff I can think of. You know, I just don't know. Like, when I would go on The Tonight Show after the first 4 or 5 appearances, I had no more material. But I would always come up with another 5 minutes after like 5 or 6 months. But then when I started and did that album, and then I did two HBOs and a Comedy Central special, and I like to have a bunch of stuff they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your material, because your material is so distinct and so unique that it's got to, even though it comes to you quickly, the wording and everything, as you were saying earlier, that it's and you're one of your unique selling propositions is that you're doing this totally original content, so you're not talking about the things, as you said earlier, that other comedians are talking about. So there's a lot of work that goes into it, right?
Yeah, this jokes are so short, and you know, only for every 3 I write or 4 I write, only one of them gets a big enough laugh to stay in the act.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm trying them out on during these concerts. I'll be trying out some new jokes. So it's like a batting average of like 1 in 3, like a baseball player. Like if he's batting 300, that's good, but that means he got out 7 times out of those 10. But so I'm like one in three works. So that means you're writing like triple the amount that ends up being in the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm curious, what does an excited Stephen Wright sound like?
Like anybody, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if someone, it's a, you know, win the Super Bowl or some, you know, home run in the bottom of the 11th, I'll be yelling, yes, you know. It's just that people know me. When I'm on stage, I'm conveying the material, so I'm taking it seriously. I don't have time to be laughing at the jokes.
No.
I'm just saying it, I'm trying to remember how the joke goes. I'm remembering what the next joke is. So I talk in a monotone anyway, but when I was on stage, it's so intense. I was afraid at first. I'm not afraid anymore, but I'm very focused. So my deadpan is there because I'm concentrating. So the audience knows me that way. That's why you're asking me, what is it like when I get excited? Because you don't see me like watching a baseball game, and you don't see me getting excited talking to my friends,
because
it's all known in this one way.
Well, I'm curious, what comedian has made you laugh the hardest?
Oh, in my life?
Yeah.
Probably Woody Allen and George Carlin and Richard Pryor.
Hmm.
And Hannibal Buress, he's like a genius, that guy. And Dave Chappelle, and Unbelievable Mind, and Jon Stewart, and Louis C.K., and like I said, Ferguson, and Letterman. I loved Letterman. And,
Are there any other arts that you're curious about exploring? I mean, you're one Tony nod away from completing the EGOT nomination cycle.
I just like continuing what I'm doing, and maybe someday do a more, a longer movie, a full-length movie, maybe someday. I did a short film called One Soldier that I wrote and directed myself. It's like a, takes place right after the Civil War, and it's funny, and it's philosophical, and it's about, you know, all, why are we here and all that, and it's in black and white, and it's beautiful, I think, and I liked doing that. So maybe some more of that sometime. But I like thinking, you know.
Yeah.
Synth and the material, the stand up is from thinking, and I don't see like an end to it really.
No, well, that's good news for us, Stephen Wright. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good talking to you. Thanks.
Stephen Wright is a stand-up comedian and an Academy Award winner. Find out more about Stephen and his comedy at wpr.org/beta.
Basically, with D'Angelo and Questlove, you have two eclectic, iconoclastic musicians, both talented in their own right, really coming together and just saying, you know what? Let's throw stuff against the wall and see what happens.
Writer and filmmaker Faith Penick on the staying power of D'Angelo's iconic 2000 album, Voodoo. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.